Well, we're going to be considering this evening from the reading that we had from the prophet Zephaniah. We're going to be considering verse 17 of chapter 3. The Lord your God is with you. He is mighty to save. He will take delight, great delight in you. He will quiet you with his love. He will rejoice over you with singing. Well, I wonder if those of you who are old enough and have children could reminisce back with me. I wonder if those of you who aren't could imagine with me that you're in this situation. It comes to the time when your son or daughter has got to the point where they're taking their driving lessons, ready to take their test, to get their own car and to attain a degree of freedom. And it's the day of their driving test, and you nervously send them off with the driving instructor. You have some nervous moments at home as you await their return. And sure enough, after a while, the driving instructor's car pulls up and your son or your daughter gets out of the car. And you watch them walking down the drive, and you can tell just from the way that they're walking that it's bad news. And sure enough, as soon as they get in the door through the tears, they recount to you how they've made a few mistakes and they've failed their driving test. And then it comes to the critical moment when they look up and look to you as their parent. And you have to say something in response. And what do you say? What do you say at that moment? Do you turn round to your son and say, "Oh well, never mind, son. It obviously wasn't meant to be. You obviously haven't got what it takes. I always thought you would have been better spending the money on a bus pass anyway." Well, unless you totally want to destroy your children, you, of course, don't say that. You offer them a word of encouragement. You say, "Now look, son, you know, don't worry. Look at your mother. She failed 3 times. And look at what a good driver she is now. You go ahead, you have some more lessons. You take your test again. I know you can do it." You offer a word of encouragement. And as believers, we often find ourselves in a very similar situation where we find ourselves through our tears looking to God for a word of encouragement when difficulties and sadness and trials come into our lives. And if ever there was a time in the Old Testament when the people of God looked to him for a word of encouragement during a particularly difficult time, it was during the time when the prophet Zephaniah was bringing his prophecy to them. It was brought to them during the exile in Babylon. They had been taken away from Jerusalem. They had been taken away from the temple, taken away from the access to the Lord their God, taken to a foreign land. How can we sing the Lord's songs in a foreign land? And they needed a word of encouragement from the Lord. And it was up to Zephaniah to go and to speak to the Lord's people and to encourage them during this time of fear, time of difficulty. And he offers them a word of encouragement. He says, "On that day they will say to Jerusalem, 'Do not fear, O Zion. Do not let your hands hang limp.'" Don't fear, be encouraged. A word of encouragement. But in order for it not just to be empty words, they needed very much to know why it was that they shouldn't fear. And why it was that they shouldn't let their hands hang limp. Why they shouldn't give up in their service for God, but should continue on. And verse 17 is the justification that Zephaniah brings to them. The reason why they shouldn't fear. The reason why they shouldn't give up serving God. The reason why they shouldn't be fearful and despondent. And so we have to ask this verse some questions. A little bit like me up here on the stand. We need to take this verse to hand and to ask it some pertinent questions and find out what it is that it has to say. So the first question we probably would ask is, what does this text tell us about God's relationship to us? Well, the text says, the Lord your God. The Lord your God. We fought a little bit, and I mentioned a little bit this morning about covenant, about how it is as believers we enter into a covenant with God. A covenant is a situation where we as God's people come to Him and we give ourselves over to the Lord, and we make a declaration that we are in effect God's people. We repent, we believe in the Lord Jesus, we put our faith in Him, we trust our lives to Him. As for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. That is our part of the covenant, where we give ourselves over to God. But the covenant is also a covenant that God makes with us, where God comes to us and says to us that He is our God. He declares that I love them that love me. A covenant, two ways. The Lord your God. I wonder if you were to sit and to take an inventory of your life at this moment. I wonder what you would list as your assets. I wonder what you can truly say is yours. You could perhaps think of your time. Although often our time doesn't appear to be our own, because so many people want to make a call upon it, want to take away our time. In a sense, we are given our lives to serve the Lord, to do His will. So in a sense, it's not really our time. It's time that's entrusted to us. We don't know how much time we've got. And ultimately, at the end of the day, we are looking forward to eternity, where time has no place, no concept, no beginning, no end. Eternity. Can we really say that time is our own? Maybe we could think of our material assets. We try to hold on to our material aspects, our money and our homes. The government like to try and take that away from us. Ultimately, at the end of the day, death will take it away from us. Can we really say that our money and our aspects, our assets, are our own? Maybe we might think of our children. But in a sense, we could say that our children are only entrusted to us by God. There will come a day when they want to make their own lives, when they marry and set up their own families and leave the home. Can we really say our children are our own? And yet, because of the covenant that we've entered into with God, we can say that God is our own. That we have a stake, a hold, a part, a very real sense in which the Lord is our God. No one can separate us from the love of God. And we might say, well, if God is all we desire, then that should make us the happiest people alive, because we have a hold on something that has eternal worth, eternal significance. And we should be able to say what a privilege it is to know that God does never forget or abandon his people. I wonder this evening, can you say with other believers that God is your God? Because it should, in all honesty, be the thing that helps to cast out our fears and encourages us on to serve the Lord. So the second question then that we might bring to this text, what does the text tell us concerning where God abides or dwells? The Lord your God is with you. Or as some of the translations translate it, the Lord your God is in our midst. He's in the midst of us. I wonder if I asked you this evening, what is the name of the church? I wonder if you could tell me from the Old Testament what the name of the church is. The Lord is there. God is in our midst. And sometimes we think of God's presence and we think, well, is that an amazing statement? Surely God is omniscient. Surely God is everywhere. Surely God is within all of the heavens and the earth. So why is this special? Well, I think when we start to think like that, we've started to confuse how the Bible talks about God's presence. Because the Bible talks about God's presence in two very different ways. Yes, in one aspect it talks about God being everywhere, that there's nowhere where you can escape from God, that God is this present in all of the created order. But it also talks of God's presence in terms of promise and in terms of privilege. It talks about him being near to those who call upon him. God is in the midst of her, the church. She shall not be moved. God shall help her, and that right early. I wonder if you remember these part of the Gospels where the disciples and Jesus are in the boat and they're crossing the sea and a storm comes up and these hardened fishermen begin to fear for their lives. And they turn round to Jesus, who's asleep in the boat, and they rebuke him. And they say, "Do you not care that we are perishing?" How amazingly they said that. Did they not realise this was the Christ? Did they not realise this was the Son of Man and the Son of God? The only one person who ever was fully God and fully man? Didn't they realise that his presence in the boat was their guarantee of security? And that is true too of the church. The fact that God is in our midst, that is our assurance of security. When difficulties and trials come, we should always remember that God is in the midst of us. God is amongst his church in the world. God is with individual congregations. God is with individual believers. God is in their heart by faith. God is in your midst. I wonder this evening, can you say that? Is God in your heart by faith? Well, let's ask the text another question. What then does this text tell us about God's capabilities? Well, it says he is mighty to save. Well, save from what? Save from robbery? Save from bereavement? Save from trials and difficulties? Well, nowhere does the Bible assure us of that kind of salvation. There is a very good biography of the missionary Adoniram Judson called To the Golden Shore. Now, Adoniram Judson was the first American missionary, and he went to Burma, or Myanmar as it's now called, and served the Lord there faithfully all his life. And I think it's one biography that Christians ought to read, because it's an amazing testimony of how, even though you faithfully serve the Lord, still you have trials and difficulties, but never anything that you can overcome, that God in his grace allows you to go through trials and difficulties because he knows they will build up your faith. God never allows anything to happen to you that he knows will cause your spiritual depreciation, that will cause you to suffer spiritually. God will never do that. He'll never lead you into anything that is unhealthy for you. Always trials that build up, that make you stronger. When I was in the motorcycle gang that I was in, I had some big biker friends. Being a short person, it's handy having some big friends sometimes. And they were some big, fierce-looking chaps, one or two of them. Big hands like shovels, and you know they weren't frightened to use them either. And do you know what? There were times though when not even having friends like that was able to help me. And I guess sometimes there are times when we look to our families for help, and they let us down. Sometimes there are times when we even look to our fellow believers for help, and they let us down. But God never lets us down. God is mighty to save. Is anything too hard for the Lord? Power belongs to God. We look back maybe at particular times of blessings in the church, and we might be fooled into thinking that God is not the same today as he was then. But God is the same. God doesn't change. Is anything too difficult for God? Is there any corruption that God can't subdue? Is there any need that we have that God can't meet? No, we are more than conquerors. And in this, you might be thinking, well, surely this is talking about spiritual salvation. Surely this is talking about the salvation that an unbeliever enters into when he commits himself to the Lord in faith. And I believe this is what the passage is talking about. Yes, there are aspects in which God is able to save us from going into situations which will be not for our spiritual benefit, but he's also able to offer us that true salvation that we have through faith in Jesus. I wonder this evening, can you say that is true of you? Has God saved you? Well, let's ask this verse another question then. What does it tell us concerning God's actions? Well, it says he was mighty, but it also, like I've highlighted, says he's mighty to save. We thought about some of the ways in which he saves us. And we can indeed take great encouragement from these. We should believers that we are being changed from glory to glory. On my computer at home, I have a program that is set to update my software. Whenever some new software comes out, it comes up and puts a little thing up saying that there are updates available. And so you click the little button and it goes off and it fetches these updates and it updates the computer. And your software then is up to date. You have the latest bits and pieces. And Christianity is a little bit like that. Sometimes we do need to realise that once we are saved, we although we can't add anything to our salvation, we do need to grow in faith. We do need to grow in the way in which we experience grace. We do need to grow in the way in which we love God and our love for God is expressed. You know, we should never stand still as Christians. I used to keep tropical fish, and I could tell you some funny stories about a person who takes hobbies too seriously, but that's for another time. But when you keep tropical fish, you soon learn that one of the things that you need to do is to keep the water moving around, otherwise it becomes stagnant and poisonous to the fish. So if there isn't a good flow of water around the tank, the fish soon become ill. And it's a bit like that with us as Christians. We do need to keep our faith moving. We need to keep ourselves growing, keep ourselves fresh. You know, we need to continually be reading the Word. We need to continually be encouraging ourselves and encouraging others. And so there is this aspect of being saved that is all about our growing in our knowledge and understanding of the Lord. Well, if we ask our text another question then, finally, what does this text tell us concerning God's feelings towards us? Well, it says he will take delight in you, he will quiet you with his love, he will rejoice over you with singing. He will rejoice over us with gladness and singing, and with his love he will calm all our fears. Here is love vast as the ocean, calming all our nervous fears and our anxieties about serving the Lord. And there are three aspects to this. The first one, it says he will take great delight in you, or he will rejoice over you with gladness, as some of the translators translate it. I wonder if that strikes you. I wonder if you see the significance of that. God rejoicing over us. We feel so unworthy. We feel so inadequate. We fall. We trip, we stumble so often, we let the Lord down in so many ways, and yet God rejoices with gladness when his people remain faithful in the face of adversity. God rejoices with gladness when his people spiritually prosper in the face of adversity. And although we may have an unduly negative view of ourselves, yet God has a true perspective and rejoices over us with gladness. Then goes on to say that he will quiet you with his love. It's an interesting turn of phrase, he will quiet you with his love. It's actually referring to the thing that a parent does when their baby is anxious and crying and fractious, and you try and soothe them. That's actually the metaphor that is being used here. And it's quite an unusual thing to think of God taking us in his arms like fractious babies and gently soothing us. God calming our anxious fears. Like we said, he's a very present help in times of trouble. Then finally it says he will rejoice over you with loud singing, or singing as the NIV translates it. Well, I wonder what you make of that. I wonder what you think of the image of God singing over you this evening, with loud singing even. God singing our praises seems almost incomprehensible. Well, when I was looking at this verse, I decided I would consult a few of the venerable preachers of years gone by, like a good Calvinist. I turned to Calvin. I looked up his commentaries and read what he had to say. And Calvin came to the conclusion on this verse and these words that these were inconsistent with the character of God. That there must be something going on in this verse that we don't really understand or don't rightly comprehend. And so he said it must be that God is using a metaphor here to try and convey something that is difficult for us to understand in a way that we can understand but yet isn't truly reflective of what he's trying to put across to us. Calvin said that this must be some sort of marriage analogy, that it's expressing the love that a husband has to his wife, because after all, don't all husbands sing the praises of their wives? Well, I thought Calvin was out on a bit of a limb with that one. So I thought, I'm not totally convinced. I better turn to the prince of preachers. So I went to my Spurgeon sermons. And sure enough, Spurgeon has preached on this passage, on this verse. And I found the sermon and I read it. And he got to this bit of the verse. And he said, absolutely nothing. In his wisdom, perhaps, or not, he had nothing to say. So Spurgeon wasn't of any help to me. So I turned to William Jay of Bath, perhaps one of the greatest congregational preachers. And this is what William Jay had to say concerning these words. He will exult over you with loud singing. William Jay said, not only does God sing over us, but this singing may be heard. And it is intended to be heard, and intended to be heard by themselves. Tis the sweet words of God to our souls, when Jesus tells us we are his and he is ours. And God designs that his singing over his people should be heard by the world too. He causes it to be heard through his grace towards us and his providential dealings with us. Well, I wonder, have you heard God singing over you? God is a very present help in times of trouble. This should encourage us all. If God is for us, who can stand against us?